Sociologists really struggle to define what a generation is. Like, what makes a generation? How do you define it? And often people talk about generation as if it's just an age thing, but people often talk about how we get more and more tribal in the West, how even in the UK we're much more tribal. We separate into different groups and hang around with people who are similar to us more than we hang around with people in geographic locations. And some sociologists even say that with the internet, you know, a generation used to be a 25-year gap where someone 25 years younger than someone older than them could not relate to them because they didn't have the same cultural reference points. But actually, with the age of the internet, that has shrunk down to 8 years. That an 8-year gap can mean that you have such a different cultural reference point that you struggle to relate. And I had that moment near the start of this series when Henry looked at Moses and brought up Charlton Heston. And I thought, who on earth is Charlton Heston? Who on earth is he? Surely, when someone says Moses, the first thing you think of is the Prince of Egypt, right? Yeah. Surely, here at the 7 p.m. service, that is what we think of. And I'm a bit of a, who by the way, I found when I was looking for that image, Moses in the Prince of Egypt was played by Val Kilmer. Did you know that? You know, very good, very exciting. He also played Batman in one of my favorite films when I was growing up. So I was very excited by that. I'm a bit of a, I love Disney. I've got Colin's Tangled and Frozen DVDs. I keep meaning to bring them. Colin pretends they're for his kids. And I pretended I took them for Rachel, but we know really. Frozen, which is a terrible film. It's a really, really bad film. I'm sorry to put that out there. Tangled, however, very good, very good. That's a masterpiece. But I was appreciating the amount of song numbers. I'm really into Disney, especially like the ones that were around when I was a kid. So sort of Lion King, Pocahontas, Little Mermaid. That sense of adventure, that sense of all those songs. And I'm not feeling the connection here. Was this one of those generational things? Have we kind of diverged a bit here? But there's a sense of Disney of just adventure at the heart of the story, isn't there? And there's always this sense of they're driven, they're motivated by love. And, you know, I was watching Frozen and this sort of roguish oaf going around doing these things, stealing, and then trying to win this princess's heart. And I thought, you know, that was like me trying to impress Rachel, trying to be a better man. And there she was in her ivory tower, looking down. But as we look at Move for Mission, I kind of think that's what it's about, isn't it? It's about that sense of adventure. No one else excited? Yeah, I thought the post-it notes were quite exciting. Very neat handwriting. I appreciated that. But you know, as we look at Go and Grow, as we look at this sermon series of Move for Mission, of when in the Bible did the purposes and the plans of God rely on his people moving, we just see that page after page after page is just an adventure all about God's people moving, isn't it? It's exciting. And it feels like we're in that season as a church. It feels like as we look at this high road, as we try and raise all this money. Is this mic really noisy? No? Oh, sorry, it's just me then. Nothing to see there. We'll cut that out, Lawrence. That's fine. That won't go on the website. it's just exciting because as we move to fulfill the plans of God, and as we see throughout the Bible, God's people moving to fulfill the plans of God, we see that actually something about movement, something about mission, something about going out is actually in the character of God. That movement isn't just an action that he does, but it's something about who he is. It's something about his heart. You know, we sung that line in that song, "You came running after us." And that biblical picture of God the Father rushing out after us. And that's central to who he is. It's not just something that he does. Story after story after story in this sermon series, we've just seen God's people moving, and it's so central to the narrative, isn't it? Have you enjoyed this sermon series so far? Yeah? What was your favorite sermon? Oh, right, not that much then. No? Go on, what was your favorite sermon? Eliot's on Caleb. That was good. Yeah, anyone else? Anyone else have any sermons that really spoke to them? Collins. Yeah, someone said Collins one as well. That's good. Tonight, we're actually going to look at an instance in the Bible where the people of God stop moving. We find ourselves 750 years before the birth of Jesus. And we see the people of God in Israel. God has led them through the Exodus, through all that amazing story found in the Gospel of the Prince of Egypt. And he has brought them into this land, and they are prosperous. And they are you all thought I was serious then. That's not a real gospel. They were incredibly wealthy. They were spreading out. They'd conquered Syria and Moab. Their borders were extended. They were powerful traders within the region. They found themselves in a great strategic position. And even the Queen of Sheba comes to see Solomon. It's pretty fancy, that, isn't it? Comes to see Solomon. And Israel just looks like settled. We are here. We have arrived. We are in this place. And Solomon starts to get foreign wives. He starts to serve foreign gods. He obsesses over his wealth. And he gets disconnected from the people. And Israel, after all this exciting movement of following God, when they get in the place where God has led them, they start to worship some of the gods that are around them. We've got a line of the kings, the first kings of Israel here, and the first king of Israel was Saul, that the people asked for. They said, we want to be like the nations around us and have a king. And that was kind of the start of the bad news, really. After that, we saw David, a man after God's own heart, who was a murderer and adulterer. Check that out. And then we see Solomon, who the people began to resent. They saw what he was doing. They saw how he was undoing where God had brought them as a people. So his son, Rehoboam, came in, and he has this like little bit of banter with his officials when he comes in of how to interact with the people. And the officials say, you know, you need to get the people on side. And Rehoboam comes out and he says, my father chastised you with whips, but I will chastise you with scorpions. What a zinger, eh? What a one-liner. That was like a Churchillian one-liner, wasn't it? And we see from that, Jeroboam, who's this exiled official who used to work with Solomon, is then brought by 10 of the tribes of Israel and made, oh, I spelled Israel wrong there, Israel, is then brought and is made a king of a different kingdom. So the kingdom of the people of God, the 12 tribes that God led out in this incredible adventure in the Exodus, are split. 10 in the north, 2 in the south. Now you look at this, and you can see on the side screen, it's not so much on that one, because that just looks white. You can see that Israel is a much bigger kingdom, that it's on the coast. So in terms of trade and where it was much better positioned. It had more tribes. It had much bigger cities. Everything about it was advantageous. Judah was smaller. It only had 2 tribes. And it was mountainous. It was just full of hills. It wasn't very farmable. It wasn't a very desirable bit of land. But it had Jerusalem. It had the center of worship in Israel. So, Jeroboam concocted a little scheme where in Bethel and in Dan, right down in the south of Israel and right in the north of Israel, he built 2 golden calves. Remember after the Exodus story that the Israelites find themselves in the wilderness and they get so impatient waiting for Moses that they build a golden calf and start worshiping it. I mean, I felt like that sometimes when the northern line's down, and I'm sat waiting for a rail replacement bus. I thought, I am so bored right now, I'm going to build myself a golden calf. But they went and did it. That's outrageous, isn't it? So they built these 2 golden calves, and people started to worship them. And people started to bring in all this worship of other gods as well. And one of the main gods they started to worship was a god called Baal. And people loved to pontificate about Baal and say, Baal was this god and this god and this god. And the truth is, he was kind of whatever god you wanted him to be. If you look throughout different ancient cultures that were around in the time of Israel, different cultures used the term Baal for their god. And he could look very different. He could be the god of the moon. He could be the god of fertility. He could be the god of thunder and lightning. He could be the god of the sea. He could be this evil master. He was either the chief of the gods or he was the son of the chief of the gods who tricked his way into power and control. So Israel settled in this land, surrounded by prosperity, surrounded by safeness, with this expanded kingdom, this incredible people who had seen the miracles of the one and only true God firsthand, they start to worship another god. It's mad, right? I think it's mad. I mean, these are the people who, in living memory, have seen God perform such incredible miracles, who've seen the Spirit of God come on their kings, who've seen incredible stuff happen. And yet, that isn't enough for them. In a place where they're surrounded by food, in that land flowing with milk and honey that God promised them, they start to worship fertility gods. They start to desire after more and more gold and jewelry, and they start to obsess over their wealth, and they start to give more and more sacrifices and more tributes to other gods that their wealth might increase, that they would become a prosperous nation. Israel is unfaithful to their king, unfaithful to their God, and most of all, they're unfaithful to the story of a God who is on the move, a God who called them out of slavery, out of Egypt, through the Exodus. They are totally unfaithful in every single way. How on earth is God going to respond to this? This rebellious people. We pick up in Hosea 1. The word of the Lord that came to Hosea, son of Beeri, during the reigns of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, kings of Judah, and during the reign of Jeroboam, son of Joash, king of Israel. When the Lord began to speak through Hosea, the Lord said to him, "Go, marry a promiscuous woman and have children with her, for like an adulterous wife, this land is guilty of unfaithfulness to the Lord." So he married Gomer, daughter of Diblaim, and she conceived and bore him a son. Now, we're using lots of Bible stories quite allegorically at the moment. We're like, let's talk about Joshua and Caleb and seizing the land, and we're going to seize the land up on the high road. We're not quite using passages like this in the same way. We're going to go and marry a promiscuous building. Doesn't quite work the same. It's not quite as catchy. Maybe doesn't quite fit in as well, not as pithy. Lots of prophets during this time, they lived out their prophecies. They didn't just write a book. They actually lived out their prophecies. In fact, a lot of the prophets didn't even write their own books. They were compiled by their own followers. Hosea was one of the first writing prophets, but we see him follow this example of his prophecy, his word, his message from God was his life. And it's one of the most extreme prophecies ever, isn't it? I mean, that is mad. I'm using that word a lot tonight, but that is. Like, God comes and says to you, go and marry a promiscuous woman. Now, lots of translators like to tiptoe around that verse a little bit and try and put it into some nice Queen's English so it sounds very polite. Some translators just say adulterous. That's a common word we use every day. But most commentators agree that Gomer was a prostitute. And we see this later on in the book of Hosea as well. But even at this point, they say for him to go and marry someone who is called an adulteress, that's sort of parlance for she is someone who sleeps with other people's husbands. And that would not be the sort of thing that someone would just do unchecked, but that would be something someone would do if they were paid for it, if that was their profession. He marries a prostitute, and then he has 3 kids with her. His life is his message. He lives out the relationship of God. In this rebellious, broken kingdom, he says, God is like me. He's married you, and you're promiscuous. You play the field. He has kids that it looks later on in the book like they're not even his kids. And he names them and he raises them as his children. He's no idea who their dads are. I mean, this is not a Disney adventure. They've not made a Disney film about this. There's no like Hosea Disney film coming out with Val Kilmer soon. That's just not happening. I mean, what a story. And one of the most remarkable things is in so many of the other prophets in the Old Testament, you see a dramatic calling narrative where God comes and they have some vision and it's this big, profound thing in this spiritual experience. And then God says, go and say this. And Hosea doesn't have any of that. God just says, go and marry a prostitute. And he does. And the thing is, sometimes that's the counterintuitive thing we're called to. That God calls us to be faithful to those in our world who everyone else has given up on. Rachel and I are involved, and Jesse and Ivan, and many other people here, I won't get into that game, are involved with the Homeless Outreach Missional Community. And we just love some of our guys. We love them to bits. But they're all over the place. They're in some of our real close friends. They're just enslaved to alcohol. It has a hold on them. They lie. They push people away. They hurt themselves again and again and again. It's this destructive pattern of behavior. And there's times where you get mistreated. There's times where your closest friends let you down, where people you've spent week after week after week helping out lets themselves and lets you down again. And we live in a culture and a society that says, you know, I have my rights. That's what it's all about. One of the lads I was playing football against yesterday called me some choice words. And said I handballed it when I didn't, and then called me the worst swear word, let the reader understand, called me the worst swear word. And I was like, excuse me? And he's like, it's just my opinion. I'm like, no, you called me that. That's not your opinion. You are insulting me, good sir. Like, I bite my thumb at you. That is not cool. But he was like, no, it's just my opinion. And that's the sort of society we live in, isn't it? That's not an alien attitude. Actually, I have my rights. I have my way. You've treated me this way. I can do what I want. That's not the way it is. That's not the way it is for the people of God, because that's not the way it is for God. Because we are stubborn and rebellious and unfaithful and turn away, and God forgives us. And is faithful, and is loving, and is true. We read on in Hosea 2. God says, I will punish her for the days she burned incense to the Baals. She decked herself with rings and jewelry and went after her lovers. But me she forgot, declares the Lord. Therefore, I am now going to allure her. I will lead her into the wilderness and speak tenderly to her. There I will give her back her vineyards, and I will make the valley of Achor a door of hope. I love that, therefore. She went after her lovers and forgot me. Therefore. Here's God, he's within his rights, If he was doing what was humane, if he was following the letter of the law, it's really obvious what God should do. And he says, because they have done this, therefore I will allure her. Some translations put, I will woo her. I will woo Israel. I will romance her. I will bring her back. I will show her my love. I will make her fall in love with me again. She who had no reason to turn away in the first place, she who had no reason to fall out of love with me in the first place, I will woo her and I will speak tenderly to her. How does he respond to faithlessness with his faithful love? And this is why we go. This is why we do look at a new building, because it's just a tool for us to continue living out this faithful love of God. Because God's faithful, loving action isn't just something he does, it's something he is. Even God's justice is him lovingly putting things right. That is who God is. He is faithful. Therefore, I mean, that is just beautiful, isn't it? He won't stop going after them. He won't stop running after them. He won't stop saving them. He won't stop seeking them. He won't stop forgiving them. He chases after again and again and again. And that is why we want to move from here. Because we don't want to be tucked out on some back road where we all know where it is and we can come and we can have great meetings. And right now it fits in a Sunday meeting like this really well. But we want a community hub right up on the high road that people walk past and can engage and come into. We want space for people to come in and sit down in a cafe and have coffee and meet and connect with the love of God through the open hands of his people. That's what we want. It reflects that faithful love of God, that sense of reaching out, of stepping out, of not just building a church to be a monument as to how great we are and how much finance we can put together and how beautiful a building we can make, but to put together a church and a building that is a monument and a testament to God's reaching out love. We want a church building that looks like an open hand, that is prominent, that is unmissable, that you can end up in by accident. I don't think anyone has ended up in here by accident. I mean, you walk 10 meters down the road and this massive building becomes invisible. It's like some sort of David Blaine illusion. I don't know how the architects managed it. This is part of who God is. We move on. God says, there she will respond as in the days of her youth, as in the day she came up out of Egypt. In that day, declares the Lord, you will call me my husband. You will no longer call me my master. And here God is saying, listen, this is who I am. That word master is literally the word Baal. And God says, no, you do not relate to God as your master, as someone that you just serve and you pay religious duty to. I am not someone that you just give a sacrifice to, and therefore you get financial gain, you get good crops, you get all those things that the Israelites were looking for out of Baal. That is not me. I am your husband. I want relationship with you. That might be really uncomfortable. That might be really, really uncomfortable language for you in a society where family units have broken down, where relationships are breaking down, where the divorce rate is so high. But that doesn't mean that language isn't true. And that doesn't mean that language isn't right, that God wants to be your husband. He wants to relate to you like a tender, loving husband. He wants to allure you. He doesn't want to be known as a master. He doesn't want to be sacrificed to. He wants to be loved. And he wants to love you. That is how we relate to this God. We move on in the story in Hosea, and we're back to Hosea himself. The Lord said to me, go, show your love to your wife again, though she is loved by another man and is an adulteress. Love her as the Lord loves the Israelites, though they turn to other gods and love the sacred raisin cakes, which sound pretty tasty. So I bought her for 15 shekels of silver and about a homer and a lethek of barley. Then I told her, you are to live with me for many days. You must not be a prostitute or be intimate with any man, and I will behave in the same way towards you. Lots of commentators think that Hosea maybe walks in on a sex auction at this point. Some commentators think that Hosea's wife has gone and slept with another man and got pregnant to another man, and that man is applying the law of the land to say, you are now mine, you are now my possession. And Hosea goes and he pays for what is already his. Outside of the cross, this is probably the biggest sign of love we see in the whole Bible. It is breathtaking and it is beautiful. And Hosea comes and he doesn't say, you have done this, you have done wrong. He doesn't punish her. He says, you must be with me. You're mine and I buy you again. We don't even read the story of how she leaves Hosea. Maybe they had an argument one day about the kids. He's got ginger hair. He's definitely not mine. I don't know. I don't know how that went. But we see Hosea coming up to another man. Excuse me. That's my wife. This is the price. No. That is my wife. That is the mother to my kids. No. This is the price. And he pays it. This is just incredible. This love that we see. We see Hosea quoted twice in the New Testament. Once by Jesus. And he says, it's from Hosea 6:6. He says, as he sat with tax collectors and sinners, and people are accusing him and saying, you should not sit with people like that. He says, I desire mercy, not sacrifice. I desire your heart, not your religion. Because that's the character of God. That's that faithful love of God. That when we are faithless and when we walk away, the first thing that he wants back is our hearts. The very first thing. Before he wants your duty, before he wants a diary of where you're going to be on a Sunday, he wants your heart. Our relationship with God is supposed to outwork itself in tender-heartedness, not in religious action. When we read the story of Hosea and we see the lengths that he went to, the life that he lived in order to enact the faithful love of God in a faithless people, it is incredible. There was a time when, just before the summer, when a homeless lady we'd had quite a bit of interaction with passed away. She'd been housed and been isolated and been shut off and moved away from her community, and she spiraled back into addiction and took an overdose. And that sent off a couple of our other just guys living on the streets drinking every day that Rachel and I in particular are just really close with. And I didn't know what to do. We were turning up every Sunday, cooking meals for 30, 40 people, trying to sit down and talk to them. And I was just angry. I was angry at the council. I was angry at the government for the way that the system worked. I was angry at the housing authorities. I was angry at private landlords and the state that they'd put this dear, sweet child of God in. I was angry at all the people who'd let her down. I was probably a little bit angry at myself that I didn't do more. Every week we were turning up and sitting next to some of the most needy and vulnerable people, and I felt powerless. I didn't know what to do. And I just started to bubble wrap my heart bit by bit. I just cut myself off. And I don't think anyone from the outside would be able to tell. I just spent a bit more time putting the chairs out. I kept buttering the bread and serving it up and going to the shop and buying the crisp and being really, really busy all the time. And I was in the right place and I was doing all the right things and my heart was not in it. And one day I was in a time of worship with some friends, and the guy at the front spoke about God wanting to call people to intercessionary prayer and wanting to call people into really feeling in their hearts for the people they pray for. And he was talking about the pain and the cost of that, and God just started to pop some of those bubbles. And it was one of the most painful experiences I've ever had. But I tell you what, when I just do my tiny little insignificant bit in the lives of some of those guys, but I do it out of a place of love and out of a heart that is loved by God, out of a heart that understands the faithful love of God, it has so much more effect. God desires mercy, not sacrifice. He calls us to be Hosea. I guess my question is, who have you given up on? Who's the adulteress in your life? Who's God forgiven but you can't? That's a tough question, isn't it? Who's the Gomer in your life? But this book goes the other way, because actually, we're Gomer. The other quotation from this book is in Romans. And Paul is writing about the salvation from God. And he quotes from Hosea how God will call us his people again who were not his people. That it's not the measure of your faith that brings you to God, but it's the measure of his faithfulness and his love. That actually, when you've been faithless, when you've looked for other things, when you've looked for satisfaction in sex, in relationships, in money, in finance, in your job, when you've comfort ate, when you've cut yourself off, when you've placed your hope in all these things that the people around us do, we live in a society full of people who are constantly putting on social media everything about their life looking for approval. Where to take photos of yourself all the time and post them up online as a selfie for people to see and engage with has become normal. Where obesity is rising more and more and more because our relationship with food is so out of kilter. Where everything is just spiraling out. Where people are in debt more and more and more. The average level of household debt is something like £23,000. Where people are just pushing out and grasping for more. They're looking to the Baals. They're looking to the gods that are around them. They're going, where is this God of success? Where is this God of money? Where is this God of sexual satisfaction? Of me being desirable? Of me having high status? Of people liking me? God's love speaks out against that. We go because God's love is faithful. That's why we go. That's why we're moving up onto the high road. That's why we do everything we do as a church. That's why if the building stuff fell down tomorrow, we would still find the next most outrageous thing we could think of that would cost all of our finance, all of our time, all of our community, all of ourselves to go and reflect his love and faithfulness. But also, we come because God's love is faithful. We are brought to God. We are called children. We are called beloved because of his faithful love. It's a little bit different than some of the other Move for Mission sermons. Maybe it's not as doesn't seem as obviously applicable. It doesn't seem as rip-roaring as let's go up and let's seize the land. But there's something in that. That it was never built on our faith in the first place. It was built upon God's faithfulness. As the band come up, let's stand. And let's just See what God's Spirit wants to do in our hearts now.